Now, I have the pleasure of introducing our first speaker. He is the Graduate Program Director in the Department of Physiology, and he received his undergraduate and Master's Science training in biochemistry and chemistry from Carleton University. His PhD comes from Harvard University in biochem. After his postdoc in France, he was hired by McGill in 1991, where he is now a professor in the departments of physiology and medicine. His laboratory has a long-standing interest in mechanisms of regulation of gene transcription. For the humanities people, you may not understand that, but he might get into that a little bit. I don't either. So in particular, the laboratory studies and physiological consequences of gene regulation by the vitamin D receptor and its role in enhancing innate immune responses to microbial infection, as well as the mechanisms underlying the putative anti-cancer properties of vitamin D. Would you please join me in inviting Professor John White to do the morning lecture?
Well, for once, it's a pleasure to be back in this room, and I'll put that in context a little bit later. Can we have the lights down a little bit? Is that possible?
No.
Okay, so I guess I'll have to just deal with it. My slides are the sorts of slides I usually use to teach in here, and the lights are down somewhat. Okay. So this is the title I was given. And I must admit I was surprised when I got this invitation. My first reaction, I won't lie to you, was, okay, who canceled? I haven't read any textbooks. I have no formal training in teaching. I didn't sit in a class like this and have somebody tell me things about teaching. I learned about teaching from being in your position for a number of years, that is to say, sitting in classes, both as an undergraduate and a graduate, and then being forced to do it myself once I got my job. And So I can't just simply start out in March of 1991 when I arrived at McGill and saying, okay, what did I figure out in the subsequent years that I needed to know? I have to give you some context. And that context is my experience in your position as an undergraduate and as a graduate student with the teaching that I was fortunate to have, that I was subjected to sometimes, and how it influenced me both as an undergraduate and a graduate student. So I'll go over a series of... I guess it shows up. There's nothing you can do. I guess it's for the video, right, that you can't turn the lights down. Anyway, so I'm going to go very quickly through what kind of training will you have as a teacher. One slide. Okay, and then, I have to provide you with some context. And who were my favorite teachers and what did I learn from them? Who were my least favorite teachers and what did I learn from them? Lessons that are almost as important. And then finally, who and what will you be teaching? Now, I must admit that, you know, when I heard David's statistic about 65% of you will go into non-academic careers, when I put this thing together, I had someone sort of following a career path that was similar to mine in an academic career. But I think a lot of it will be relevant. At least I hope it will. And then finally, at the very end, sort of take-home tips that you can take or leave. Okay, so what kind of training will you have? Well, virtually no formal training. I mean, in my case, none. In your case, well, you're here. And, you know, talks like mine will remain more or less indelibly etched on your brains for the rest of your careers. I don't know. All right? But if you're anything like me, you will be formed as a teacher largely by your own experiences from sitting in class and from the person that you are, your own personality. Okay? And, of course, there are many different people in this room and many different personalities, and you don't have to be one personality type necessarily to be a good teacher, and I'll provide you with some examples of that. So as David said, I started out at Carleton, I spent 6 years at Carleton as an undergraduate student, as a master's student. And I then went on to do my PhD at Harvard. They don't have exactly the same reputation, but I'll defend my undergraduate education at Carleton to anybody, because I came across a couple of terrible teachers, a few terrible teachers, but I came across a number of excellent teachers who had major influences on, well, first of all, me staying in science. Because when I started out at Carleton, I was at Carleton because I was an indifferent high school student, and in my first year at Carleton, of course, as part of a four-year program, I was an indifferent university student. And it was my teachers in my second year at Carleton, the equivalent of U1 here, who woke me up. And just in the nick of time. But if it wasn't for those teachers, I don't know where I'd be now. Certainly wouldn't be standing here in front of you talking to you about teaching and graduate teaching particularly. Anyway, so I'm going to go through three or four people. This fellow, Peter Cruz. So I went into biochemistry. There's no biochemistry. There was and there still isn't a biochemistry department at Carleton. So you did a biochemistry program in a chemistry department. And this fellow, Peter Cruz, who unfortunately died far too young, a wonderful fellow, he's Estonian. Now, the only two words of Estonian I knew, I learned, were Peter and Cruz, but one of the things I did learn, that Estonian is easy. It's entirely phonetic. Everything is sounds the way it's spelled. So Peter Cruz taught physical chemistry, a subject going in I had to take. It was a part of the program I had no interest in whatsoever at the time, at least at the beginning. And I will remember his lectures, you know, for the rest of my life. You look at the photo. I mean, it's him, a quiet man, an intense man, but intense in a kind of passionate way. A guy you really wanted to get to know. And a guy who really made physical chemistry very, very interesting. And I'll tell you, one of my pet peeves about being a teacher today, and it's something I tell all of my undergraduate classes, is I think you have far too many tools. There's far too much media, there's far too much this and videos and whatnot. Peter Cruz used a piece of chalk. He wrote everything out in beautiful handwriting on the board, and we wrote everything down. And to this day, I keep telling students, don't just sit there and mouth breathe in class. Throw away your yellow highlighter. Write notes. Because when you go back and you look at your notes, you'll remember things that you otherwise wouldn't have remembered. If you sit there and watch a video in your apartment or something because you didn't bother to go to the lecture because, hey, it's on video, I mean, your metabolic rate drops. You're not as engaged as you are when you go to class. This is what I tell people. And it's from this type of experience. He also had a knack of bringing sort of physical chemistry into the day-to-day world. So we talked about weather. We talked about garden hoses. You know, anytime I buy a garden hose, I think of Reynolds numbers, and I buy the biggest garden hose I can. You know, I understand how Chinook winds work, how air conditioning works to this day, okay, because I took this course. I didn't become a physical chemist. I had no intention of it, but I loved it by the end. And so he was a quiet man, but he had a passion for his subject. And it was infectious. And then there was this guy, who's still going. So Ken Story was just starting out as an assistant professor when I was an undergraduate student. And he taught metabolic biochemistry, okay, which was, you know, oh. Back in those days, metabolic chemistry, biochemistry was definitely not sexy. It has become sexy for the simple reason that there's an obesity epidemic. And tons of biomedical researchers have gone into metabolic biochemistry, also because we now recognize there's a connection between obesity, inflammatory diseases, cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's become cool again. Back in those days, it definitely wasn't cool. All right? But he made it absolutely fascinating. And he, if anything, is on the opposite end of the personality spectrum from Peter Cruz. He's intense, but there's nothing quiet about his intensity. So now, this link doesn't work, so are we still connected here? Okay. So I'm going to show you a bit of a video. Hello? the tyranny of technology. Why am I not working here? Let's just try this again. Now, we may go through ads for shampoo and whatnot or something like that, I don't know, before we get to this. Maybe we won't. And anyway, at the time, I think he may have mellowed a little bit. He's in his 60s now. Oh, come on. But he was borderline loony. And yet, I mean, loony in a good way. He really made it a lot of fun. Oh, this is very disappointing. Ah, okay. Of course, it worked perfectly when we set it up this morning, right? What I'm going to do, I think. Oh, it's really too. Okay. All right.
Ken Story is a very respected scientist. He holds the Canada Research Chair in Molecular Physiology. So what's he doing at this pond with waders on? The answer lies here with the wood frog. It's one of the few creatures that can freeze and thaw as easily as we humans sleep and wake up.
All right.
To withstand freezing and survive.
So he studied metabolic adaptation to extremes. In this case, the wood frog, it can freeze and it can thaw. And so we move forward here, and you'll get an idea, just a little flavor for what this guy was like.
Relatively fat and happy.
That's why the frog looks relatively firm.
So that's a frozen
healthy,
frog.
Even when it's frozen. But what about its brain? How could that survive such an ordeal?
It's surrounded by ice. It's the worst ice cream headache ever. And yet they're fine. If by fine you mean brain dead. So we put little electrodes in the frog's brains and we watch them when they're frozen, they actually go brain dead. So in the beginning they have little froggy thoughts, and then they go brain dead for the time of freezing, and then when you thaw them out, they go right back to normal. To be able to turn off a vertebrate brain and then have it return undamaged, unconfused, is amazing.
The thawing process.
So I'm not going to show you the rest. You'll have to go onto the Discovery Channel site yourselves. But you get an idea, okay? And that's the mellowed 60-year-old version, right? So that got me into biochemistry. That convinced me that biochemistry was interesting. And honestly, I continued in it because of his lectures. And he really engaged the class. Then there was this fellow, David Gardner, who taught neurobiology, and he puts you in the historical context of the discoveries as they were being made. What were people in the field thinking? Why were the discoveries so revolutionary? He gave you a real sense of context, and each lecture sort of unfolded as if it was a chapter in a novel. And it was fascinating. And of course, it helps that he's the ultimate Renaissance man. He came in occasionally. He looked like that. Take away the gray hair. For him, black was the new black. So, black turtleneck, black jeans, that kind of thing. You get the idea. He was a cellist for the Ottawa Symphony Orchestra. He's a Renaissance man. So he was fascinating. He had a passion for the subject. And he got me interested in learning the history of the fields that I was in. Okay, at least he was the first person that got that going in my mind. Now we move to graduate school. This is my PhD supervisor, okay, Charles Richardson. And he's another one who got me interested in the history of the field. For reasons I'm not going to go into, when I went to Harvard, I applied to the department I did to work in a specific lab. And I realized after two or three visits to the lab that that was the last place on earth I wanted to work. And so I was lost. And he was looking for a graduate student in a totally different field. And I kind of went, fine, I'll do it. It turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. But it was an entirely new and alien field to me. I knew very little about it. I had very little background as an undergraduate in that particular field. And so one of the things that interested Charles, and one of the things that he got me interested in again, was the history of the field. It gave me a sense of belonging to the field. As I'll get to in a minute, he had an interesting way of communicating. I came in one day and there was this book on my desk, Phage and the Origins of Molecular Biology, which ultimately became an undergraduate course that I taught here at McGill. And I sort of looked at this and I said, where did this come from? And the postdoc who was sort of opposite me said, well, Charles put it on your desk. And I said, well, I think he wants you to read it. Okay. That was his way of communicating, okay? And again, it gave me a piece, it gave me context for what I was, you know, the field that I was engaged in, where I stood in sort of the history of the field and everything, and it made it, for someone starting out in the field, it made it much more interesting. And so, you know, it becomes important. I'm not going to go into the details of this slide, but if you understand some of the history of molecular biology, these are highly schematic representations of pieces of DNA that you actually use in an experiment. Why do I have no pointer here? So this bit of DNA comes from yeast, brewer's yeast. This comes from human herpes virus. And this comes from fireflies. Okay? This bit comes from humans, and this bit comes from yeast. And, you know, if you're learning molecular biology for the first time, you said, what the hell? I mean, why? And the history gives you the why. Okay, I can tell you the what, but it makes much more sense if you understand some of the background. Okay, so who are my least favorite teachers in what the land? Where, then there's this guy. So, Charles, he was not a great communicator. And the other thing is that he was a wonderful guy. And generally speaking, the atmosphere in the lab was wonderful. But he was not someone to sit down with a young graduate student and have the equivalent of a fireside chat. If you walked up to him with questions about science outside the context of a group meeting, his body English would say, I'd rather die than have this conversation. And you gave up on it. And I realized, we did have group meetings. There were 15 or 16 people in the lab, almost all of them postdocs, and one person presented every week, period. So you had 15 or 16 weeks to get up there, present your stuff, and get some feedback in some sort of a formal way, and almost none of it came from Charles. So I recognized, and this was difficult, this was extremely difficult for me, because I went from Carleton to Harvard, and I had an imposter complex for about 3.5 years. That I realized I was on my own. And honestly, it was scary. And yet, what it taught me, in the end, it was a very valuable experience, because it taught me I had to go and figure out who my friends were, what my resources were, what I could learn from which person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I had to go out and learn to become independent. Okay? Whether this is part of Charles' actual design, I don't know. But that's what it was. At the end of it, when I did get my PhD, and the other thing that, one of the few comments he made about my thesis work was to, after I'd been in the lab for about 3 years, was to a visitor to the lab, and he said, and this is John White. He's the other graduate student in the lab, and his project is a graduate student killer. And I thought, well, thanks, Charles. But that was the extent of the communication, the nurturing. There was very little. You had to go out and figure it all out for yourself. Ultimately, when I did get my thesis and my project worked, I realized that I was the guy who had done it. And ultimately, that was an extremely valuable experience for me. But it's not the way I run my lab now. I can't do that. And yet, you'll see, well, we'll get there. Okay? So, who will you be teaching? Well, I suppose you, to this crowd, this is fairly obvious. Entry-level undergraduates, upper-level undergraduates, and grad students. Now, I don't separate entry-level undergraduates from upper-level undergraduates, because I consider entry-level undergraduates to somehow be lower life forms or anything like that. The reason is, you'll see, you're not going to be teaching in the same types of courses. Okay? your own graduate students and postdocs, your peers, and the general public. Okay? And we'll go through each of these. So, lecturing to undergrads and grad students. And if there's something, if you want to take home, a soundbite to take home, take this home. Easy courses are hard and hard courses are easy. At least in my experience. So, teaching the easy courses, and I'm talking about entry-level undergraduate courses, survey courses. Large amounts of material covered in a relatively superficial level. Large classes of students. So, I kind of get a case of the shakes being in here because I teach a lecture to this class when it's absolutely packed. And it's one of two lectures that I teach in the morning. The 8:30 one is at the Palmer Howard Amphitheater in front of 400 students, and this one is in front of 650. It's the same class. Okay, there are 1,100 students or something like that. We have overflow rooms, the whole thing. It's a gigantic class. The other thing is the backgrounds of the students are highly variable. Okay? So this is entry-level physiology. We have Med-P students who sort of are bored most of the time. You know, teach me something that's interesting, please. This is all so easy. And then we have physiotherapy, occupational therapy, nursing, etc. The backgrounds are not the same. The language skills are not the same because a lot of times with the PT, OT, and nursing students, this is the first time they have had lectures in English. So the question is, at what level do you pitch the material? You can't pitch it to the 5% Med-P students. We've got it about right, judging by the class average. Okay, but it's very difficult to please everybody. So, you know, what do you keep in? What details do you leave out? We'll get to that in a minute. These are all real challenges. So, what other challenges are there? You may be asked to teach material for which you don't feel qualified. So, my background as a postdoc was really studying the biochemistry of a process called gene transcription, which is the first step in production of proteins within your cells. And I was in a lab that studied the receptor for the steroid hormone estrogen. And the reason that that is relevant is that the receptor is actually in the nucleus of cells. And if you're a geneticist and interested in DNA, that's downtown. That's where the DNA is. All right, and estrogen binds to it, and it basically turns something that's a sleeping protein into an active one. And in the lab that I was in, estrogen was simply a useful switch to turn this thing on. The lab was not at all interested in female reproductive endocrinology, estrogen physiology in any way, shape, or form. This was just a useful thing that we could turn on and off to study gene transcription, period. And yet I arrive at McGill, and I'm hired at McGill for two reasons. First of all, I have an expertise in this sort of in a series of techniques called molecular biology that the physiology department lacked, and I could teach endocrinology, and they needed somebody like that. And so I was told, okay, so you're going to teach endocrinology, and I'm going, okay. I had to go and learn it. I had taken the equivalent of a 200-level course in endocrinology, 95% of which I had forgotten. Okay? The only stuff I had remembered was the stuff that was, in fact, wrong. So there's this steroid hormone that regulates salt balance. It's called aldosterone. And the teacher at the time, this was in the 1970s, after the first Rocky film came out, kept on calling it aldosterone, as if it was Sylvester's brother or something like that. The rest of it I had completely forgotten, and I had to go out and learn the material. Now, conceptually, it was straightforward. Much of human physiology is a series of negative feedback loops. I'll get into that in a second. But there will always be gaps in your knowledge. And I'm going to get very philosophical on you in a minute about that. Okay? But this can be a problem. Because your level of confidence is never what it is when you're teaching the stuff that you've lived for the last 15 or 20 years. And questions in a class of 1,000 students can come from virtually anywhere. And you can't answer all of them. Okay? And it's to this day, after 21 years at McGill and teaching this course for about 17 or 18, the 2 weeks that I teach in this course are the two toughest weeks of my academic year at McGill. And that's not going to change. Okay, so this, I couldn't resist putting this in. So 70% of this is a total tangent, but some of it's actually relevant. So read this. This is a pronouncement by former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who was the closest thing to a philosopher in the now-defunct Bush administration. And I remember when he said this, because it was all over the news. I was driving home, and I heard it on the news, and my initial reaction was, you clown. But then I thought about it, and I said, he's crystallized something here, and this is very, very useful. And I'm actually serious, as much as people are laughing. People have a tendency to laugh when I get serious. So there are your known knowns. Now, forget undergraduate teaching for just a second. If you go into research, particularly if you're entering a new field, these are the sorts of things you cling to. This is what we know. This is what the paradigms of the field are attached to or clinging to. Don't get too attached to the known knowns, because they may prevent you from seeing other things. So if you know that protein A works in this way, it may prevent you from seeing that maybe protein A sometimes works in another way, for example. So there are very few known knowns that are carved in stone, certainly in biomedical sciences. I mean, I don't know, maybe in history I can't believe that things don't shift, opinions, et cetera, et cetera. So don't cling to these things too much as they make you feel secure. We'll get to your known unknowns in a second. And then there are the unknown unknowns. I mean, in my particular field, with the techniques we can use today in molecular biology and genetics, we can amass massive amounts of data. And we had a specific question in mind, and maybe 0.5% or 1% of the data is relevant to the specific question. In other words, those are our known unknowns. Those were the things we were looking for. The rest of it, we either were too ignorant to think about or had no notion was going on. And these are your unknown unknowns. And it's because we stumbled across one of those in my laboratory that produced the paper from my laboratory that is going to be the most highly cited paper that we ever produced. And these are the things that are actually the most fun when you stumble across them. All right, now back to undergraduate teaching and our known unknowns. One of the things that I have discovered and has been extremely frustrating is when you do a survey course and you're sort of learning new material, you ask yourself questions, and sometimes students from the class will ask you questions about things that you don't know the answer to. And so you go and look it up. But the problem is that you don't know the answer for one of two reasons, either because you're too ignorant or because it is not known. Now, when you're looking something up, if you're consulting Dr. Google, and you're looking for something, an answer to a specific question, and you can't find it, you don't know if it's because you haven't found it or because it's not there to be found. And I'll give you, I'm a biomedical researcher. I teach endocrinology, so I can't leave without dealing with a little bit of endocrinology here. So this is a condensed version of some material from my undergraduate lecture that I give here on glucocorticoids. Glucocorticoids are a class of steroid hormones. One of the frustrating things about glucocorticoids is they do lots of things. So they can affect electrolyte balance, salt balance in your blood, for example. They're used clinically as immune suppressive agents, anti-inflammatory agents. And if you ever are given glucocorticoids, it's probably for this reason. But glucocorticoids are called glucocorticoids because they act to raise levels of glucose in the circulation. In fact, if you look at glucocorticoid levels in the circulation, they fluctuate during the day. This is called the diurnal rhythm. Okay? I always remember to say that because I asked the question on the exam, diurnal rhythm. And you'll notice that they're highest when you get up in the morning. So you get up in the morning in fighting form, you've got circulating blood glucose, which is to be used as fuel for your cells for the day. Okay? So this makes perfect physiological sense. Remember this thing called ACTH. That actually tells the body to make more glucocorticoids. And we'll get back to that in a second. So how do glucocorticoids do this? Well, what they do is they actually, so we're carbon-based life forms. We're full of molecules that have carbon skeletons. And the proteins, sugars, fats, nucleic acids like DNA and RNA, they're all carbon-based. And those carbon units are interchangeable. So proteins can be broken down and rebuilt as fats or rebuilt as sugars. Fats can be broken down and rebuilt as, you get the story. So what do glucocorticoids do? Glucocorticoids stimulate the breakdown of proteins to their constituent parts, and then those constituent parts are further broken down to build glucose. They also accelerate the breakdown of fats, okay? And the constituent parts of fats go in to build glucose, and your glucose levels in the circulation go up. Fine. That makes all perfect sense, and we know that. At least we think we do. All right, no, we know that, okay? And so you figure if someone has some sort of a pathological condition where they're constantly producing too much glucocorticoid, so there is a condition called Cushing's disease where ACTH is basically up here, and glucocorticoid levels are high all the time. The diurnal rhythm is gone, and the body is cranking out large amounts of glucocorticoids. So you figure glucocorticoids are breaking down proteins, muscle wasting goes on, you become osteoporotic because your bones, which are calcium on a matrix of protein, start to break down. And also, they should be breaking down lipids. So it should be a wasting disease. People should just get skinnier and skinnier. These are two people with Cushing's disease. All right, elevated levels of glucocorticoids. They are not skinny. Cushing's disease is characterized by elevated levels of fat deposition. And when I was setting up my lectures, I like showing pictures. They're more interesting than bullet points. I was going to put this in. I said, well, okay, so but why are these people fat? And I went looking for it. And I did it in successive years while I was preparing this, and I couldn't find anything. I tried to contact a couple of MDs who never got back to me at McGill in one of the teaching hospitals as to why this is going on. And I finally stumbled across someone who's an expert on Cushing's disease and said, we don't understand. Okay? So I don't tell undergraduates this. I censor this because I'm afraid it's confusing. You know, they're writing all this stuff down, breaks down lipids, and they go, but they're fat. What do I have to know for the exam? Right? And it took me a while to understand this. Okay? So the other thing we don't understand, okay, the whole notion that there's fat deposition, why this buffalo hump occurs, and only in 50% or 30% of the patients, nobody understands. A total mystery. So it's very frustrating. And if you're teaching a broad course, there's lots of stuff like this. This is one example of many. Okay, so teaching upper-level undergraduate and graduate courses, you know, the hard courses. It's a piece of cake. It's fun. All right? They're almost always much narrower in content. Well, as you know, you're graduate students, right? Generally much closer as a teacher to your specific area of expertise. Essentially always, you choose the entire content. You can pick and choose what you want to teach. And more importantly, I'm certain in my case, I'm a much more interesting teacher to graduate students than I am to undergraduates, because I teach the sort of stuff I've been living for the last 25 years. And that I have, in some instances, either as a postdoc or in my own laboratory, have actually contributed knowledge to. All right? And that automatically makes you more engaged in the subject. All right, and the other thing is, remember I said this thing about known knowns and the fact that, well, they're known until we figure out that that's not the whole story. You have seen the field evolve over the last 20, 25 years. And it really helps you put things in context. And the result is it's much more interesting, I think, from not only my point of view in terms of teaching, but also I think from the point of view of the students. And as well, okay, you know this. I mean, generally the classes are varying formats, so there are fewer stand-up lectures, you know, fewer sets of PowerPoint slides and things like that. There's discussion of papers, and then you get to pick apart papers and you know, critique papers, which is very interesting because many, I don't know, For you in history, many scientific papers are revisionist history. The story is told not in a way that the story unfolded scientifically. And of course, this facilitates interactions with students, and there's lots of room for critical analysis, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So teaching your own graduate students. So in a research lab, a good graduate student, at least this is in biomedical research, has to have obviously a good brain, an engaged brain, an imaginative brain. But also there's an element of cuisine to doing biomedical science, and you need to have a good pair of hands. And, you know, you take a student, I mean, ideally you take a student with an excellent academic record, because that usually takes care of A. Not always, but usually. B is a black box, is a mystery when the student comes into the lab. And I was somebody who sucked at the bench for about 2 years until I started to get my act together. And then things just became that much easier. Other students hit the ground with their feet running. And it's not necessarily the ones with the high GPA who do that. So this is the big unknown. And it's also difficult to teach. They basically have to figure it out for themselves. A lot of it is manual, and so, you know, you just have to learn to be patient. Each student comes online at their own pace. And again, there are two extremes of teaching, directing graduate students. There's day-to-day micromanagement. You know, you're looking over their shoulder as they're pipetting every day, which is something I'm not an advocate of. Or there is the come back in 5 years with a PhD, right? Which, you know, in reference to this guy, he's a wonderful fellow, but one of the postdocs in his lab uncharitably said, John, you have to understand that Charles is a graduate of the Mushroom School of Management. And I went, put them in the dark, feed them shit, and watch them grow. Okay? Great. So, okay, it's fun. It's easy to make fun of this having been through it and survived it and all that sort of stuff. But nonetheless, it's useful. There's a lesson in there, and there's a constructive lesson. And a lot of times what I do as a supervisor of graduate students is I'll let the students start out a little bit on their own. And just see, you know, what do we got here? Is this student an initiative taker? Is this student able to sort of go out and, you know, have the wherewithal to figure things out on their own? And particularly with a PhD, PhD students are much more interesting to supervise because you've got a certain amount of time. I don't like to have my PhD students hang around in the lab any longer than is necessary. But you've got to let them have time to become independent. And, remembering my PhD experience, I do sort of let them go initially. And then, you know, if things clearly are not working, the scale will shift back to, closer to day-to-day management of what is going on until things start to roll on their own. So, you know, I learned a lot from my negative experiences. In their way, they turned out to be positive in some respects. So again, the PhD is the most essential step on the road to becoming an independent researcher. And it should teach you independence. And if you feel that you haven't got that when you've got your PhD, then you haven't had an optimal experience. And therefore, you know, encourage the student to go out and figure where his or her resources are so that, you know, the learning experience is as much as possible given the specific student is an independent one. The other thing is, in my particular field, it's to a large degree technology-driven, and a lot of times it's the graduate students, and on a number of occasions it's the graduate students and the postdocs who introduce the new technology into the laboratory. It's not me. I mean, I'm doing other things. I'm not out there in the lab every day. And, you know, so there's a lot of positive things that this can bring back to the lab. Okay, teaching your peers. 10-minute talks are much tougher than one-hour talks. You really have to figure out exactly what you've got to say and what you should leave out to get in, to get things done in 10 minutes. Because you've got all kinds of cool stuff you want to talk about, and you just haven't got the time. You have to learn to judge your audience. You can't give the same talk to different audiences. I'm in a physiology department, incredibly diverse. I can't give the same talk I would actually give to, and I'm in the department, I can't give a talk at the same level to people in my department because of the diversity than I can to a biochemistry department. The other thing is, if I talk to physicians, they're not interested in the same things at all. They'll turn you off like that, unless you're speaking to them I won't say the level they can understand, but in a context that they're interested in. The other thing is, when you put slides together, don't clutter them up. Let them talk to you. Enough information to let them talk to you. I get a lot of papers to review that have plots that look like this, and I have to go to the figure legend to see what's going on. And occasionally people give talks with stuff like that. Whereas, you know, a minimal labeling will help not only you remember what's on the slide, but will also help the people in the audience as well. Teaching to the general public, and here I'm going to close up. This is not easy. It's very difficult to determine exactly what to say. In part, you have to learn to leave out the sort of details that for the public are totally unnecessary to the sort of the bottom line. And this is often the type of stuff that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's very difficult to figure this out. And yet, on the other hand, you have to add details that you might not, you know, you would think are obvious. So when you say the vitamin D receptor is a protein, maybe most members of the general public will think a protein, you know, throw another steak on the Barbie, or is that like soy, or, you know, stuff like that. You have to explain these sorts. And it takes a while to figure this out. And you'll be doing it in several different ways. Writing a review on your own topic for a general audience is easy, but not as easy as you'd think. Then there are interviews with print journalists. Those are not so bad. They can be edited or in some cases mangled. It's happened to me. Both have happened to me. Interviews with radio journalists. Again, you have to figure out what you're going to say ahead of time because there are no takes, right? And then TV is even worse because there's a whole issue of composure and, you know, I mean, my say you need good hair is just sort of, you need to feel confident about yourself when you're sitting in front of a TV camera, right? And then just to close, tips that you can take or leave. Be yourself. There are lots of different types of people who can be passionate and interesting teachers. And I leave you with Peter Cruz and Ken Story as two very different personalities, but two fascinating teachers. And try and bring a level of passion to the subject. The students will definitely pick up on it. It really does make a huge difference. And again, as I say, consider providing a little historical background where appropriate. It provides context, and it also makes certain facts, you know, a little bit less dry. And with that, I thank you. Sure.
Do you have any questions this morning for Professor White?
And after 21 years, I'm no longer afraid of saying I don't know. So you can go ahead and ask me anything. Yes. How long did it take me to feel confident about teaching? I still don't feel confident about teaching entry-level undergraduate courses. I'm never happy with the level, you know, what information is being given, et cetera, et cetera. Graduate students, I just loved it from day one. I also love giving talks to my peers. I'm talking about my own stuff. There's no one answer to that question. I mean, it's there's a certain irony to doing this in this room because, you know. Yeah.
Do you ever try to do small group discussion or activities when you're teaching a really large group?
So do you ever try to do small groups when you're teaching a really large group?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the answer is basically no. Within the course that I teach, there are tutorials. And those wind up being small group things because basically only 5% of the class shows up. Okay? Which I think is really dumb because I honestly, to this day, believe FaceTime with the professor is the most important tool that you can make use of in teaching. And I don't care about all the computer wizardry or anything. I mean, if you've got that's the other thing. If you have an engaged speaker in front of you, when you're reading your notes, you remember, it brings things back that you would otherwise have forgotten. Okay? I did teach an undergraduate course for a number of years based on that book, Phage and the Origins of Molecular Biology, that was limited to 20 students. Okay? And that was terrific. Okay, it was an exercise because, again, you had to figure out what to keep in and what to leave out and what they were understanding and what they weren't. But it took me a couple of years to sort of tune it right. But, you know, that was a wonderful experience. Yeah?
Assessment. How do you deal with assessing?
Well, I mean, I suppose I could, and I'm not going to do it, answer 1,000 essay questions or mark 1,000 essay questions. And if I ever did do something insane like that, I would allow them to do it, answer in either French or English, because that becomes an issue of fairness to people who are dealing. This is something that's probably specific to McGill. Most of the time it's multiple choice. It's done because it's really the only practical way to do it with 1,000 students in the course. And the only way I can say we're getting it about right is the class average is around 73% on each exam. Okay? We don't fail a lot of students. We fail some. And also, there are only a handful of A's, which I think is about right. I mean, if things were starting to get packed up at the top, then I don't think you're giving the students the experience they need. So... Yeah. No, you.
That was you?
Yep, it was you.
Okay. I've wanted to know for some time now, with respect to multiple choice questions, I've had exams before there would only be about 20 multiple choice questions versus, say, 50 or, I mean, when it's not so difficult to mark multiple choice questions, so what's the logic in providing a certain number of multiple choice questions?
Well, I mean, the logic is you have to have enough questions to basically give some kind of coverage of the course. Okay? You also tailor the number of multiple choice questions to the length of the exam. Okay? And I can tell you, so in our courses, there are midterm is very easy. They have 100 multiple choice questions on two exams, 30 in the midterm and 70 on the final. Each of them are worth 1%. All right? And I can tell you that the best students leave the final exam an hour before the allotted time, right? And yet, 25% of the class is still there at the very end. So it's, you know, I think we've got the length about right. That's the way it, those are the criteria we use to judge how many questions. And the number of questions you're given as a professor, of course, reflect the relative number of lectures you've given the course. And the students are given that information ahead of time.
Gentlemen, Professor John White.
So what do I do with this?